Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. Our first guest today is James Bamford, the acclaimed journalist who specializes in national security issues. His new book, just out with some blockbuster revelations, is entitled The Shadow Factory, Inside the Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to Spying on America. And then we'll be talking to perhaps the best financial reporter out there, David K. Johnson, the Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times investigative reporter who spent 40 years of his career exposing collusion between government officials and private sector entities as they enrich the rich and ignore consequences of middle-class labor and the poor. And he's won many awards for his remarkable career, including the Pulitzer and the George Polk Award. His most recent book, Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with a Bill, is a broad examination of shocking collusion and unfairness, ranging from subsidies for professional sports stadiums to secret payouts to multinational corporate chief executives. Free Lunch has special relevance today in light of our current economic calamity and the massive bailouts for Wall Street, in which, as Johnson's title says, the wealthiest Americans have enriched themselves at government expense and stuck you with the bill. So we'll be talking to David K. Johnston. I'm now speaking with James Bamford, who's an acclaimed journalist specializing in national security issues. He's the author of the best-selling book, Body of Secrets, The Puzzle Palace, and A Pretext for War, 9/11, Iraq, and the Abuse of America's Intelligence Agencies. His writing includes investigative cover stories for the New York Times Magazine, the Washington Post, and the Los Angeles Times Magazine. His work has appeared in many other publications nationally and internationally, and his report in Rolling Stone entitled The Man Who Sold the War won the 2005 National Magazine Award. He is formerly an investigative producer for ABC's World News Tonight with Peter Jennings and a distinguished visiting professor at the University of California at Berkeley. His new book, just out with some blockbuster revelations, is entitled The Shadow Factory, Inside the Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to Spying in America. And Jim Bamford, it is an extraordinary irony, at least to me, that the president has said that those attacked us on 9/11 attacked us because of who we are, not because of what we do. And they hate our freedom. So in response to those who attacked us, we attacked our own freedom. Do you get the impression that anybody in this country understands the full scope of that kind of absurdity?
It's hard for me sitting here to understand what the rest of the public understands. But no, I really don't think the public has a real grasp of it, largely because of all the brainwashing that went on right after 9/11 in terms of why they attacked us. You know, they don't like our Supreme Court or something, these absurd things the Bush administration was putting out there to try to distract the American public from the real reasons they were after us, which was our foreign policy. I mean, they didn't attack Canada, they attacked the United States, and for the reasons of our absurd policy in the Middle East that we've had for so long, that was only compounded after 9/11 with the invasions of Iraq and now this sort of switching to what may be an endless war in Afghanistan.
Well, you know, it's not as if the writing hasn't been on the wall going back to the Founding Fathers. Ben Franklin said that those who would trade liberty for temporary security deserve neither liberty nor security. And I'm trying to find some kind of patriotic ground here where people can have the confidence in the wisdom of the people who founded this country and the principles upon which it was founded and the freedoms upon which it was built. This is a form of suicide that we're going through.
Well, and I think the best way to, you know, get the world to appreciate democracy and want to have democracy is to be a shining light, a good example for the rest of the world, somebody to model after. But we've gone in the opposite direction and become a country that everybody hates. We've become, in the eyes of a lot of the world, we've become the Soviet Union of the 21st century, a country that invades other people, that occupies other people, that doesn't join international trade agreements or international ecological and various other agreements that we want to be on our own and the hell with the rest of the world. I mean, that's the attitude that we projected over the last 8 years, and it basically serves the opposite ends of what the administration has been trying to do.
Well, Jim Bamford, we're going to talk in a minute about the Shadow Factory, the ultra-secret NSA from 9/11 to the eavesdropping on America. And the book, of course, lays out an enormous amount of information about what's really going on in the name of the war on terror, the extent to which all of our communications now are intercepted, whether you have links to overseas terrorists, and it's hard to believe that there's too many people in this country that do have links to overseas terrorists, and it's furthermore hard to believe that, given the technology out there, that they're not all arrested by now. So the bulk of this activity seems to be a vast fishing expedition. So the technology is there. But I would add, Jim, that if you've been watching the news lately in the presidential campaign, the psychological framework for a paranoid right-wing America is being laid at these Sarah Palin rallies and in general with the John McCain campaign and with Congresswoman Bachman the other day on MSNBC saying that, asking to return to the days of McCarthyism, saying that there are subversives and there are un-American people and there are un-American congresspeople and the press should investigate who's un-American in the Congress. And the divisions are being laid out. They started in the Republican convention with Giuliani and these others basically saying that there are patriotic Americans and there are unpatriotic Americans. And they have used that cleavage that with a hatchet through the very body politic of this country.
When you see how influential it could be when you get up on the soapbox and start screaming about terrorism and terrorists and fear-mongering, that's part of the reasons we were led into the war in Iraq. The administration managed to convince about 70% of the public that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11. So even after all the evidence came out about phony weapons of mass destruction, there was still a large percentage of the American public that believed Iraq was behind 9/11. So I think that's the idea here. If you say it enough times, if McCain and Palin say Obama is a terrorist enough time, people are going to believe it. And I mean, some of these rallies, they almost sound like once the rally's over, they'll go out and start burning books or something. They're very frightening sometimes. Yeah, what you're saying, though, is very true. What we have now today, what I write about in my new book, The Shadow Factory, is how NSA, the financial industry has been deregulated. Well, NSA has been deregulated under this Bush administration. And the problem with deregulating NSA is that it takes all the safeguards and the oversights and the protections away from the American public and lets NSA largely decide who's going to be eavesdropped on in the U.S., and they don't have a very good record in terms of watching their own people in terms of who they listen to. So I've found a couple of the people who actually do the listening, the intercept operators, the people with the earphones on. And they told me that they were given a waiver to begin eavesdropping on Americans. And once they were given a waiver, they were told to eavesdrop on every call that came in, every call that came through their system, regardless whether it was Americans talking to their spouses, Americans overseas talking to their spouses back home, bedroom chatter, personal finances, whatever it happened to be, and that was journalists or soldiers or aid workers, whoever happened to be on the phone call. And they got very angry about it, and they protested, but they were told that's the order, eavesdrop on everything, record everything, transcribe everything. And so these calls for 7 years now, whatever, all these calls from innocent civilians to their families in the U.S. are in a big data warehouse now that NSA is building down in Texas. It's a warehouse almost the size of the Alamo Dome to store all the new intercepted conversations.
And these are the private conversations, and this has been in the press quite a bit in the last week. Revelations from your book, Jim Bamford, the Shadow Factory, the ultra-secret NSA from 9/11 to the eavesdropping on America, and that the press has seized on these stories of how soldiers serving in Iraq have their private phone conversations with their spouses and girlfriends and boyfriends and whatever monitored by these people, then you've found a couple of people that have done it and given firsthand accounts. It is so obscene to think that this is the administration, and particularly Palin and McCain out there on the stump talking about how much they care about our boys and girls in uniform and how they're serving the country bravely and how much they support our troops. And yet they're allowing the invasion of the privacy of these people who are on extended tours doing this hideous job that these two draft dodgers in the White House never stepped up to the plate to do themselves when they had the opportunity.
And it's even worse. They're not only intercepting, recording, and storing these conversations for what amounts to forever. When they get a conversation from a soldier or a journalist or a worker or business person, whoever is calling to the U.S. from the Middle East, and they're talking about sex, or they're talking to their girlfriends about can't wait to get back and see them, or their spouses or whatever, bedroom chatter, they take these calls and they pass them around and laugh about them and say, listen to number 37 on your computer there, get a big laugh out of it, or whatever. And so it's adding insult to injury. Not only is this stuff being listened to and recorded and stored away, it's being turned into a bathroom laughter, basically, for soldiers sitting in these listening posts in the United States.
As much as it's an obscenity to do this to the men and women in uniform who are over there in this hideous environment fighting George Bush's war, the real obscenity, I think, is that the enemy that we're supposedly the excuse for which is proffered in order to invade the privacy of everybody, including the people who are fighting the war on terror, is that we've got to find these terrorists, and particularly the ones over here and their links to the Middle East, etc. And I understand from talking to CIA people and other military intelligence people that Al-Qaeda, not that there's much of it in any case, it's largely a myth, but what exists of Al-Qaeda, don't communicate on cell phones anymore. They communicate by courier. They've gone incredibly low-tech. And some of the foreign intelligence operations that we want to penetrate have all gone into fiber optics. So the impression I get is that so much of this is really a war on the American people, not on America's enemies.
That was also one of the impressions I got from speaking to the intercept operators when I interviewed them for the Shadow Factory. And they were so angry about all this stuff, which was very rare for me, having finished the third of three books on NSA. Very rare for one of these people to actually allow me to use their name and for them to go completely public. It's very dangerous for them to do it. They have no benefit from it except getting the message across that what they're doing they don't agree with and it shouldn't be done. But what they also tell me, in addition to eavesdropping on Americans, they weren't doing much eavesdropping on the enemy, basically, the people that they were supposed to be eavesdropping on. For example, they didn't have anybody there that spoke Pashtun, which is the key language used by the Taliban in Afghanistan. This is the same time we went to war with Afghanistan, with the Taliban, and we had nobody that spoke the language. And they tried to set up a small class to teach Pashtun, but the intercept operator I spoke to said it was largely a disaster. They weren't even telling the person who was teaching the class why they were teaching it, so they were teaching conversational Pashtun instead of looking for target words and that kind of thing. So it ended up being that most of the calls that this one intercept operator was dealing with were almost all American or almost all Westerners who had no connection with terrorism or anything. This was because the terrorists, as you mentioned, are not using some of these telephones. They're being far more secretive, and they're meeting in person, and they're sending couriers, and they're avoiding this whole network of NSA's interceptions. So what they're left with a lot of times are not the terrorists, but they're left with Americans calling Americans.
The NSA, though, itself, I don't see them as inherently evil in the sense that they're a large military bureaucracy, largely with military technicians, and they used to be very neutral until Bush unleashed them on the American public. To me, the villain in this is Bush and Cheney and their sense of hubris and the unitary executive that they've decided, they've declared a war that makes them wartime presidents and therefore not subject to the notion of, that you know, the Constitution constrains them in any way. The idea that intelligence skills can be used against American citizens, not just to spy on them, but to perhaps, you know, I don't know whether you saw that movie Michael Clayton, but this corporation, the lawyers hired ex-spooks to assassinate a troublesome witness. You know, I get the feeling that we're heading in that direction.
Well, sure, and this was one of the new things about the new book, Shadow Factory, that I just finished, that was different from the previous two books I wrote on NSA. Just to reiterate your point, most of the people that actually do this work are very honorable and do very hard work. The two of the intercept operators that I spoke to, the two that came forward, I spoke to others who wouldn't let me use their name, but these two that are coming forward or said they're coming forward because they joined the military in order to go after terrorists, and they were angry that they were being forced to listen to Americans instead of doing what they were supposed to be doing. So I give them a lot of credit. But getting back to your issue of the topic you just brought up of sort of privatization of NSA's eavesdropping, I found that really extraordinary this time, because before it had been strictly NSA that would do the eavesdropping, and so NSA was responsible for everything they did, and NSA, at least theoretically, reports to the Congressional Intelligence Committees and so forth. This time it's been so diversified that they're allowing a lot of companies, some big companies, some small companies, companies people have heard of, some companies people have never heard of, to do a lot of the eavesdropping. They even put ads in newspapers asking people that have held these high NSA clearances, people who are now civilians, to come work for these companies and put on their earphones and spy for Booz Allen or these other companies. And again, now you have private industry doing this, and you're getting far away from the possibility of having proper oversight over all this. The other thing I found, which was rather frightening, that I really doubt that Congress has any idea of, one of the things that I really highlight in the book, The Shadow Factory, is the fact that you have big companies like AT&T and Verizon who do the telecommunications, but there's these small companies that specialize in eavesdropping that act between the telecoms like AT&T and NSA. So it's actually these small companies whose equipment and software is being used to intercept all those communications and then pass it on to the NSA. And the frightening thing here is you have people, these two small companies, who are the actual tappers of AT&T and Verizon, are foreign companies that were based in a foreign country that may have ties to foreign intelligence services and that are basically tapping into all our domestic and international communications. So the communications will go from AT&T to companies like Naris and Barrent, these two eavesdropping companies, and then from then they go to NSA.
Jim, who owns Verint and Naris?
Well, they were founded by Israelis in Israel, and they've acted as the sort of the key intermediary between the telecom companies and NSA. It's their equipment, their software that does a lot of the eavesdropping. And one of the companies, Verint, one of the big problems I found with Verint is that the founder of Verint is now a fugitive in Africa. He's hiding out in Africa, and two of the other, he's a fugitive from the U.S.
Well, what's he charged with?
Wanted for a number of felonies involving fraud and theft, and he's hiding out now in Africa. And then two other senior executives from the company pled guilty to fraud and theft charges. So these are the companies that are doing a lot of the, or at least building a lot of the equipment and the software for all the eavesdropping that we're doing. So
it's worse than that. I mean, people in this country don't realize that the United States Congress, every phone, fax, and email to the Congress, from the Congress, among the Congress people, is controlled by an Israeli company. And if you go to uscongress.gov, this foreign-owned Israeli company controls and monitors all of the activity.
Well, to have foreign companies, foreign-owned companies, companies that are based in countries that have spied on us before, just doesn't seem to make much sense. You know, if the NSA wants to eavesdrop on AT&T, it ought to design its own equipment, build its own software. I mean, we pay $8 billion or more a year for this agency. Why do they have to outsource the wiretapping of America to foreign companies? It just never made any sense to me. And that was when I was writing The Shadow Factory. That was one of the things that really shocked me, because in the two previous books I wrote, there was never any indication that they were outsourcing to foreign companies the tapping of U.S. domestic, international and domestic communications. One of the things that's very striking is that I trace the routes for all the telecom cables coming in and going out of the U.S. And on the Pacific coast, they all come ashore at a little place in Morro Bay, basically. About 80% of all the international trans-Pacific and Asian communications comes ashore there. And it goes to this sort of windowless building owned by AT&T. Now, if you only wanted to eavesdrop on just international communications in and out of the United States, which is largely what the administration says, that is where you would build your secret NSA room, because that's where everything comes in and goes out of. But instead, what I found was that they built their secret tapping rooms in places like downtown San Francisco in the AT&T's very large, I think it's 10 or 12-story building, which is basically one big telecommunications switch. And by building the tapping room there, they not only get the international, a lot of the international communications, but they also tap into the entire domestic network. So we're not talking about just listening to and from the U.S. We're talking about having the same communications that goes through this equipment is the same communications that are internal to the U.S., from Kansas to Nebraska or whatever. I mean, these are the same domestic communications that go through the NSA's eavesdropping hardware and software as the international communications.
Again, I'm speaking with Jim Bamford, the author of The Shadow Factory. He also revealed that the NSA, of course, has now converted a lot of the submarines. You know, they've got all these underwater platforms, tridents, that have, since the Cold War, we don't need that many nuclear weapons targeted against Russia. They've, of course, back in the days of the Cold War, there was the Operation Ivy Bells that, in the Sea of Okhotsk, where the U.S. submarine tapped into the underground, the underwater cable from Moscow Center to the Far East Command in Kamchatka. That was compromised, actually, by an NSA defector, was it not?
Yes, that's right. Ronald Pelt, he gave the secret away to Ivy Bells, and so the Russians were able to secretly find the tap down there. And then, knowing that those cables were tapped, they sent a lot of disinformation over those same cables for a number of years.
So, what are these submarine platforms, spy platforms we have now, do? I mean, they go under and they look for cables and tap into them. Is that?
Well, I talked to people who were very knowledgeable about that whole topic, and they said that the U.S. has developed this one submarine in particular. Ironically, it's the USS Jimmy Carter, which is a large attack submarine, and they've converted it into an intelligence and eavesdropping submarine designed to go to the bottom of the sea and tap into fiber optic communications. It's unlike the Sea of Okhotsk and copper undersea cables, which was much easier. Tapping into fiber optic cables is very difficult because what's going through there are light beams instead of electrons. So the U.S. has not been able to, from what I understand, successfully do much tapping into undersea fiber optic communications yet. They may in the future, but right now they haven't. So. The result is that because they can't really tap into these cables undersea, that's why they have to make these secret agreements with the telecom companies in order to build the secret rooms into the AT&T and other telecom companies into their switches.
Right. So they got
to
get.
They can't get access to it undersea. They have to.
They have to go to the terminus and tap that.
Exactly. They have to go to where the. Before they were able to do this without ever. Any connection to the telecom companies when they were intercepting the communications from satellites and so forth. They just put a big dish out there and collect it. But once in the late 90s, all these majority of communications switched from satellites to undersea cables, that's when NSA was now forced to begin making secret agreements with telecoms in order to get physical access to the actual cables.
Sure, and that was at the heart of the FISA bill that there was a lot of debate about, and unfortunately it passed. Barack Obama even voted for it, the compromise, they call it. Hillary Clinton voted against it. But the long and short of it is it was a get-out-of-jail card free for Bush and Cheney, who had violated the law. They couldn't afford these lawsuits to proceed because they would have revealed the extent to which you're revealing in your book, Jim Bamford, how much we've been spied on. It's an extraordinary story, isn't it, how the Democrats rallied to Bush's defense. Do you get it?
Well, I was hopeful there for a while. It seemed like when the temporary bill expired last February that the House Democrats and some Republicans refused to agree to a new bill, to renew the bill and put a permanent bill in there. So that went on from February until last summer, and then it looked like as the election was approaching, the Democrats and the others who were withholding their vote on it decided to cave in and give in to the administration, largely because they were afraid of accusations by their competitors or their opponents in their elections. As the election was coming closer, they got nervous about being called soft on terrorism.
Right.
And as a result, they passed the bill.
But look what's happened, Jim. I mean, you know, if Barack Obama was afraid of being attacked for being soft on terrorism, and that's why he voted for the FISA compromise, he's been attacked for being a child molester and a terrorist. I mean, what did he gain? I thank you again for joining us here in Los Angeles and for your book, The Shadow Factory, Jim Bamford.
My pleasure, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Jim Bamford, the author of The Shadow Factory, The Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to the Eavesdropping on America. This is a book that's revealed some extraordinary information that a lot of the press has actually picked up on. They picked up on the extent to which the government is spying and monitoring and listening in and being amused by phone calls between soldiers and their next of kin from Iraq to and Afghanistan to the United States. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's a whole lot more going on. The book is so thoroughly researched, and it's an absolute hair-raiser. Let's now talk about the economy. I know so many of you are interested in what's happening. We've never seen anything like this. Most commentators have suggested there's never been anything like this since 1939. Not a particularly comfortable analogy. And, of course, the head of the Fed, Ben Bernanke, apparently is a lifelong student of the Great Depression, but that doesn't necessarily mean that his stewardship at this moment is going to avoid a repeat of what happened back then. I'm speaking with David K. Johnston, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times investigative reporter who has spent his 40-year career exposing collusion between government officials and private sector entities as they enrich the rich and ignore consequences for middle class and for the working poor. He has won many awards in his remarkable career, including the Pulitzer Prize and the George Polk Award. He has uncovered so many tax dodges that he's been called the de facto chief tax enforcement officer of the United States. His latest book, Perfectly Legal, was a New York Times bestseller and honored as Book of the Year by the journalism organization Investigative Reporters and Editors. His most recent book, Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. It's a broad examination of shocking collusion and unfairness, ranging from subsidies for professional sports stadiums to secret payouts to multinational corporate chief executives. Free Lunch has a special relevance today in light of our current economic calamity and the massive bailouts for Wall Street, in which, as David K. Johnston's title says, the wealthiest Americans have enriched themselves at government expense and stuck you with the bill. And David K. Johnston, how many people are involved in this wholesale looting, not just of the United States economy, but the global economy? It seems to me that if you, and I don't know whether anybody's done the forensics on this, but it seems to me that it's probably less than 100,000 people have engineered this amazing ripoff I'm not talking about the realtors and the bottom feeders down the food chain, but people who actually knew that what they were doing was going to enrich themselves and impoverish the majority of citizens out there. And this contagion is spread around the world, and we don't know how bad it's going to get, but we already know that millions of people are losing their homes, their stability, their future, their families. It is a monstrous crime.
You know, that's a very interesting question, Ian. I must say, of all the hundreds and hundreds of interviews I've done in the last 10 years, nobody's quite asked that one. If anything, your estimate of 100,000 is probably high. There are, of course, many facilitators and courtiers who are helping in this, but the gains are unbelievably concentrated in very, very narrow hands. You know, it wasn't too long ago that $1 billion was thought of as an incredible fortune to have. We now have at least three Americans we know of whose income last year was more than $3 billion.
Then these are hedge fund operators, are they?
Those, that's right. Those are hedge fund operators, and we
who pay 15% tax, right? They don't even pay normal income
that's
tax.
Right. They pay 15%, while the typical school teacher, police officer, nurse is paying a marginal tax rate of more than 40% because of the income tax plus the Social Security and Medicare tax
and payroll tax.
That's what I mean by the payroll.
Oh, I see.
Social Security, Medicare tax, and. But it's a very, very narrow slice. I mean, there are a lot of people who get, you know, crumbs off the golden cake, but the real slices of cake are going to a very small number of people. Here's a little number to think about. Back in 1980, the top about 27,000 people, I'm sorry, 24,000 people in America got one penny out of every dollar of income. Today, 1,000 people get one penny out of every dollar of income in this country.
Well, it's you know, it's enough to make you a Marxist, I think. I mean, I was looking at a graph the other day that showed how household income and productivity have run in parallel for decades, and we all know that wages have been flat since the 70s, but productivity suddenly spikes up in about year 2000. And household income starts a slow and steady decline, which indicates that the beneficiaries of productivity in this new economy are capital, and the losers of productivity in this new economy is labor. And the only way that we've kept a pace with the standards of living of other Western democracies is through credit, through cheap gasoline and cheap food. Well, it looks like those days are over.
Well, seemingly cheap gasoline. You know, one of the anomalies in this is that, well, the price you and I pay for gasoline right now, I just filled up at $3.30 here in New York State. Remember that we maintain this enormous military apparatus even before the war in Iraq to assert our control, to prop up regimes that we think will be friendly to us. Kind of an interesting thing for a government that supposedly believes in market economics to be doing. And that is an extra toll on you, largely focused on the supply and cost of gasoline.
Again, I'm speaking with David K. Johnson, the Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times investigative reporter who's covered Wall Street and the economy and our unfair tax system in this country where... we're having a sort of repeating of way of what happened under President Reagan, where he cut the taxes for the wealthy and ran up the deficit by increasing, in his case, defense spending. Not that President Bush hasn't done the same. And then running up the national debt, the service on the debt is compulsory. It's almost like double jeopardy because the middle class and the poor pay the disproportionate shares of their taxes, and then they have to service the debt that the wealthy own. So it's pretty obscene, isn't it?
Well, you know, so one of the most salient aspects of what's going on in our society is that all of this enormous growth we've had, I mean, there has been tremendous growth since 1980. The nation as a whole even with this fallback, is twice as wealthy as it was in 1980. But the gains are going to a very narrow slice of people. The bottom 90% of Americans, their tax returns show, have the same income adjusted for inflation today that they had in 1980. They had a bigger income back in 1973 than they do today. But when you get to the top rungs, it isn't even the top 10%. That's roughly everybody makes over 100,000. It's not the top 5%. That's everybody makes over 150,000. It's not the top 2%. That's everybody who makes over a quarter million. It's not the top 1%. That's everybody who makes over 360,000. It's the top half and tenth and hundredth of 1%. The top hundredth of 1%, that's only 30,000 men, women, and children, they make almost 6 cents out of every dollar of income today. Back in 1980, they got a penny. And so their incomes have soared through the roof, while the bottom 90% have been flat. And even at the rung to enter the top 1%, your income hasn't gone up that much. It's up less than a percentage point a year over all that time.
As far as I can tell, they've never been able to, Obama's never been able to pin down McCain, because when he mentions that McCain wants to give tax breaks to the rich, as George W. has done, McCain never answers that question. Instead, he talks about Joe the plumber, for God's sake. I mean, don't you find it extraordinary that the average Joe and the people out there at McCain and Palin's rallies, who are not wealthy people, I'm quite sure of that, somehow that simple truth has not been exposed?
Well, yes. One of the big changes that's taken place in America from when I was growing up in Southern California in the 50s and the 60s was that blue-collar Americans read the newspaper, and they typically read more than one. And I can remember in the mid to late 50s sitting around Coley's Barbershop in Orange, California on Saturdays, and all the older men would be talking about Sunkist. They were all growers, oranges, lemons, et cetera. And, of course, they were all convinced that Sunkist was always cheating them. But they would have a bunch of newspapers there. They'd have the L.A. Herald, the L.A. Examiner, the Daily Mirror, the Times, the Orange County Register, the local paper in Orange, which doesn't exist anymore. And they would talk about what was happening. And they understood that government was central to their economic well-being. We've lost a lot of that. And it is astonishing to watch some of the reports that are now on the Internet that you can see, other than from the big networks, of journalists who've gone out and interviewed people at rallies. And they believe the most astonishing things. I mean, some of them are the functional equivalent of thinking the Earth is flat. And this, the success of those people who want an oligarchy and who want to shift the burden of taxes off of themselves onto everybody else so they can have his and her private jets that you and I subsidize as taxpayers and other baubles like that, and persuading them to these ridiculous notions that have no basis in fact whatsoever about how the economy is organized and how it works, they're just astonishing. And, you know, the one that the major news media get wrong all the time is the income tax, is the tax burden, by confusing the income tax, which is about a third of all taxes, with taxes. Of course high-income people pay most of the income tax. The whole principle of an income tax is you don't tax the basic income people need to live on. We start taxing incomes through the federal government at $9,000 if you're single. If you're a married couple, it's in the teens. But if you have two children, we don't tax you on your income until you hit about $44,000. That's one of the good things the Bush tax cuts did. It did provide real important relief for low-income families with children. But what people don't recognize is that people who make $50,000 to $75,000, they bear the same burden. That is, they pay the same share of their income to the federal government as people who make over $10 million. I'm sorry, they pay they pay less than people who make over $10 million, and the same as people who make over $100 million. That's absurd that someone who makes $100 million or more a year has the same burden as someone who makes $50,000 to $75,000. Absolutely absurd.
Well, but what's happened here is that this deregulation and all this free market and the notion of taking the handcuffs off the millionaires and putting them on the welfare queens, as Ronald Reagan told us back in the 80s, has led to the evisceration of our economy. It's led to the socialization of enormous debt. And in just this last week, all the nation's top bankers had to sit down and sign a piece of paper that the Secretary of Treasury was forcing them to sign. And some of them, like the Wells Fargo Bank, didn't want to sign it, but they had to. They're saying, no, we don't have these problems. What's happened so far?
Is that
with
the bailout, Ian?
Yeah, but you compare to what Gordon Brown and the Europeans have done, they've actually acted and they got money in the system and they're doing stuff. There's a 700 or up to $1 trillion that Paulson's got discretion over. What's he doing with it? I mean, there's a sense that I have that he's taking care of his friends.
Well, this is, you know, the very kind of thing that both Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch are about. And when the bailout was announced, as soon as it was announced, I posted at a blog that journalists all over America go to called Romanesco, a long piece that began with, "Journalists, start your skepticism." And I posted a series of questions. Now, I knew the answers to these questions. A couple of snarky people put them on the web saying, "Oh, here's the answer to these questions." That wasn't the point. It was the hope that journalists would ask questions of the kind that weren't asked in the run-up to the war in Iraq. And if you have a government that we now know, you know, was lying through its teeth about weapons of mass destruction, I mean, we now know they didn't know. There's no question about that anymore. They did know there were no weapons. That we now know that they were aware of that. A government that will lie through its teeth about going to war presumably will have no trouble about lying about money. And the problem with the Paulson plan is that it doesn't address what we know from history is how you deal with this kind of problem. And here we have Ben Bernanke, arguably the greatest living authority in the world on the Great Depression. And this cannot have been the plan he put forward at all. This was a plan by the former chairman of Goldman, Secretary of the Treasury Henry Paulson, for Goldman to benefit Goldman, that reflects Goldman's view of the world. And Paulson took several actions that should really trouble people, that even if you think he was operating with a pure heart, his actions scream scandal. First of all, he wouldn't rescue a competitor, Lehman Brothers. Now, both the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times have quoted all sorts of people involved in this as saying that the reason that the panic set out was the failure to save Lehman Brothers because of all the complex financial deals that upset. So he got a benefit of destroying his former employer's competitor, and it set off the panic. Then, when the Federal Reserve decides to rescue an insurance company, American International, there's one person in the room, we find out from the New York Times, who was not a government official. It's the chairman of the board of Goldman. And it turns out that AIG owes Goldman about $20 billion. That's half of the net worth of Goldman Sachs. Then they appoint a guy from Goldman to be in charge of the $700 billion. I mean, all cash flows in this matter lead back to Goldman, Ian. And that's critical to understand what's going on. Now, they've now switched directions. After stampeding the Congress into voting for this with the help of the news media, and, you know, I saw John Harwood, who is a contributor to the New York Times and MSNBC, say on a television show that all of the calls to people saying, don't vote for this bailout, to members of the House, he described that as harassing your congressman. Not exercising your constitutional right to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Not, even if they're wrong, celebrating that the citizenry is finally engaged in their government instead of worrying about who will be the next American Idol, but haranguing their congressman. I mean, that's the way the Beltway looks at the rest of America. Now they're doing something that makes more sense. It is what Bernanke has apparently now been freed up to do, and that is they're injecting capital into banks to maintain liquidity. But we should never have gotten into this situation. We are in this situation because 28 years or 30 years, because it really started in the Carter administration, 30 years of Milton Friedman politics, of Reaganism, of this notion that we don't need to regulate these big institutions. They will be self-regulating. They are run by responsible people, and government just gets in their way. Well, you know, when you and I drive down the highway, we're pretty responsible, right, Ian?
Right.
Well, so listen, then why don't we just get rid of stop signs and traffic lights and drunk driving laws and speed limits? Because most people are responsible. I mean, doesn't that sound like a terrific idea?
Well, I mean, but isn't the ultimate irony, David K. Johnson, it's when these so-called beleaguered businessmen are finally freed from all the shackles of regulation, they commit financial suicide.
Well, yes, being too clever by half is always a problem in the business community. You know, Enron, I broke the story, and I tell in Free Lunch the story of how Enron did not pay taxes. In fact, we found out later, because Congress did this gigantic investigation with an 1,800-page report based on my story in the New York Times, that Enron didn't pay taxes. That Enron not only didn't pay taxes, but Enron internally referred to its tax department as a profit center. And they had figured out through all of these machinations how to actually profit off taxes. The problem is they were too clever by half, and they destroyed the whole business. And when you remove these shackles, and when you know that nobody from the government's going to come in and look at your books, they're not going to come in and look for tax reasons, because we have, you know, eviscerated the detective squads of the Internal Revenue Service, and they're basically the tax police. We've handcuffed the Securities and Exchange Commission staff. That's the Wall Street cops. We have cut and handcuffed the banking regulators, and then we've allowed this whole unregulated shadow banking system to arise. If you think nobody's ever going to look over your shoulder, of course you're going to do stupid things. It's just human nature.
Well, of course, the Enron loophole, which was what Phil Graham, who was John McCain's campaign co-chair and his chief economic advisor up until recently. And
oh, he's still in their advisor.
I'm sure he is. And this, you know, he could even be the next Secretary of the Treasury if McCain and Palin get elected. But he, of course, pushed through the Enron loophole in the dark of night in 2000. You know, the other champion, of course, of all this deregulation and a big promoter of derivatives was Alan Greenspan. Some of these people, the villains are pretty identifiable in this. I mean,
yes,
we're talking about $62 trillion. That's the New York Times figure, that there's $62 trillion of derivatives out there in this dark market that Phil Graham enabled. What are they tethered to?
Well, that's sort of one of the great mysteries. It is very clear that these things called credit default swaps, that's basically I'll pay you a fee to guarantee that I will get paid off from some of the deal, they exceed the total net worth of the United States of America. That's how huge they are. They didn't exist. Now they exceed the net worth. So one of the things that's clear is that there appear to be many, many cases where there are multiple obligations for the same debt. The problem with an idea like credit default swaps is that so long as you have normal business conditions going on, occasionally somebody goes out of business and can't pay their burdens, or they're slouching towards bankruptcy, then the insurance pays off. But when you have a general collapse, which is what we're seeing, then that system cannot work. And clearing up this mess is going to be a real problem, and this is not going to go away soon. Now, there are lots of very strange things being proposed right now. Even, you know, some of the economists on the right are proposing that the government simply bulldoze houses all across America to remove the inventory of unsold houses, which is now, you know, many months long.
I mean, now just stop for a second there, David K. Johnson. That seems to be the most cruel and insane thing. You have homeless people and perfectly good homes, and you want to knock down the homes?
Well, it is. I mean, it is one of the things we have done in the United States, and in Free Lunch, Ian, I tell a lot about this, is we've lost sight of moral principles. Remember, economics, when it began, was called moral philosophy. That's what Adam Smith was called, a moral philosopher. Andrew Mellon, the oil and bank oil man and banker who was the Treasury Secretary in the 20s, he wrote a book about taxation in which he said that we should tax workers less on their wages than we tax capitalists on their capital income. And yet our political mantra these days is we have to eliminate taxes on capital. You won't have a job if we don't eliminate taxes on capital. We have to tax your wages. It is, we have completely lost sight of the historical moral precedents for our society. One of the things I've been urging audiences to do, and I have a whole section in Free Lunch about this, is go read the preamble to the Constitution. And I got onto this because I've given talks to college students everywhere from, you know, Yale and Stanford and USC to community colleges in Kansas and a few high schools. And I've been asking students, what is the purpose of the United States of America? Why did we create it? And the most common answer that I get, and it's regardless of school, doesn't matter what the demographics of the school are, the most common answer I get from young people is, well, to get rich. Well, if that's the reason that we created the United States, we aren't going to last very long. And the preamble doesn't say that at all. It talks about the commonwealth, not private riches. It talks about justice. It doesn't talk about private riches. It talks about liberty. And we have lost sight of that. We have become almost turned into a religion, a civic religion. Taxes are bad, and we must cut taxes, especially for the rich. And secondly, it doesn't matter if we spend money we don't have by borrowing, which, of course, puts you in hock to somebody and is a mortgaging of your future. And thirdly, regulation. Evil, bad thing. We don't want to have regulation. We've lost sight of human beings, Ian.
But David K. Johnson, when John McCain and Sarah Palin say in this, they've invented this guy who was actually a plant from the beginning, this conservative guy that showed up at an Obama rally, Joe the Plumber.
Yeah, Obama walked over and talked to him, you know, and he's a big boy.
But the long and the short of it is they've used this guy as a kind of icon for their deception, because what they're saying, they keep saying, is that Obama wants to spread your wealth around as opposed to spread the wealth of the super rich who've benefited so extraordinarily under George W. Bush. And I just keep watching it time and time again. I guess if you keep repeating it, somehow it works. But I mean, do we have a real problem in the country, in as much as maybe half the country is only interested in belief, not fact? I mean, how do you explain it?
Ian, one of the critical things I think has gone on, and I've been at this game for 40 years, is we've seen this attack on the quote-unquote liberal media, which I've always found to be hilarious, because in my finding, everybody right. I know in Europe thinks of even the most quote-unquote liberal newspapers in the United States as being center-right. But I think that a lot of that is simply a substitution, a transfer, for people who hate the fact that we had the civil rights movement. They don't want to sit next to black and brown people on the airplane or in a restaurant or work with them, especially when they have one of them be their boss. And so there is this attitude, and it is not socially acceptable to express that attitude, so you take it out through transference to something else. And politicians have been exploiting this very ruthlessly and successfully for a long time. We've had a number of instances now of reporters who have been roughed up at rallies, and we have a whole set of people in America who, they basically have adopted the view they don't care what the set of facts are; they have a set of beliefs, and that's a real fundamental problem, because the whole concept of democracy depends on that. You remember Thomas Jefferson said, "If the people are well informed, you can trust them to run their own government."
Indeed, and the idea was to have ordinary people vote for extraordinary candidates, not ordinary people vote for ordinary candidates. I mean, Palin is running saying, talking about small town American values and the as opposed to the elite, and the elite is un-American, and they're the true America. I mean, it's an amazing appeal to sort of know-nothing values.
But, you know, it wasn't that long ago when Richard Nixon put forth a judge, and I don't remember if it was Carswell or the other one, but Senator Roman Hruska, when this jurist was described as just being an average jurist. Mm-hmm. He said, well, aren't us average people entitled to representation on the Supreme Court?
Right.
No,
yeah.
I'd rather have a government that's run by smart people.
Right. Right. He struck a blow for mediocrity. Yeah. Well, you know what Somerset Maugham said, that the great comfort to the mediocre is that they're always at their best. but let me just in closing, David K. Johnson, to go back to where we started, we talked about earlier and asked about how many people ripped off the world economy, made millions for themselves, and impoverished the millions and millions of people. And we don't know exactly where the bottom is in this. People are losing houses every day and every minute of the day. So you said less than 100,000. Some of them, though, are pretty identifiable, aren't they? We talked about some of the enablers like Phil Gramm and Alan Greenspan, but isn't it true that there's another guy called Paulson, right? Yes,
who is one of the hedge fund operators. You know, people need to understand, Ian, what a hedge fund is and why this is so crucial to their well-being. You go to one of the issues we're hearing about housing is, well, you know, all these people bought houses with little or no money down, and they paid too much for the houses. And we should go back to requiring people to have a 20% down payment to buy a house. Well, hedge funds borrow 30-1, and they borrowed from the bank where your paycheck is. Now, that's the official claim, they borrow 30-1. In free lunch, I proved that in some cases the borrowing is 250-1. Because they leverage in stages. Well, if you borrow $1 put up $1 and borrow 250 and the stock market overall, wherever you're investing in, goes up by a dollar, you make out like a bandit, right? You make $250 minus your expenses. But if your stock price falls, you can be wiped out. And the dangers posed to us by this unregulated borrowing in the hedge fund area, where a lot of the equity they put in came from the public pension funds that you and I as taxpayers will have to make up for if this goes badly, through higher taxes, through endowments for universities and colleges and other charities that foolishly got into these things because they're not prudent. This is speculation. This is not investing. They trade in and out of stocks. Bing, 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 bing.
We're out of time here, and I so much appreciate you joining us. And
take care.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with David K. Johnson, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times investigative reporter. I'd like to thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Tina Yonis, the assistant producer, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer. This program is available at ianmasters.org. Bye for now.